As of late, the burning question within the manosphere, and more specifically the men's rights movement, has been to be political or not. I think the answer is a simple one. The men's rights movement will at some point make its inevitable debut on the political scene. Now, in doing so, it will confront a dualistic political system hostile to the needs and interests of men on both sides, contrary to the growing cacophony of screeching rightist partisans insisting that the MRM immerse itself in their personal political milieu, the sour, stipulatory stench of red, white, and blue, good old red-blooded American nationalism emanating from their breath, you know, that kind of sanctimonious, fake, self-contradicting, patriotic douchebaggery that this picture encapsulates pretty perfectly, I think. This sums up quite nicely, I think, just what kind of baggage an MRA endorsement of right-wing politics would bring with it. You know, that certain type of cringe-inducing right-wing charm, that peculiar Santorum-esque brand of morality, and that gung-ho, freedom-loving, except when the Patriot Act is keeping us safe, and Christian, except when it's time to bomb Iraqis, hypocrisy that is inextricable from mainstream right-wing politics, no matter how many different conservatives inhabited right-wing political infrastructures. It should be noted, and noted clearly, that there are a great many conservatives, fiscal and constitutional or otherwise, that are concerned with rectifying genuine issues catalyzed by a great many characteristically liberal left-wing dysfunctions. And yet, the above characterizations of the right-wing establishment will remain and persist despite their efforts. The purpose of this video is to address the current push within the men's rights movement towards conservative politics that translate in the end to nothing more than GOP business as usual. Now, the obviousness of left-wing establishment politics being incompatible with the goals of the men's rights activists are assumed here, and as such, I will not cover them at length here. What will be addressed is the much more subtle, but just as negative implications of a right-wing affiliated men's rights movement and what specific political actions can be adopted by a politicized men's rights movement. A fledgling MRA movement, having not the political clout nor the financial capital to bring even the most simplistic male grievances to the fore, simply cannot afford to make the baggage of right-wing politics its own. Such a move would put us squarely in the trench warfare struggle of right versus left politics, where one side gains ground only to be beaten back by the other, back and forth, perpetually, without either side making any real ground. Partisan wedge issues dominate left versus right politics, and any alignment on the part of the men's rights movement with the right will result in our being tasked with guarding a remote outpost, signifying our metaphorical grievances and their priority to the right, very far, far away from the front lines where the real battles take place. Abortion, the war on terror, military spending versus entitlement spending, these are the issues that a partisanized men's movement would take back seat to. Again, I want to concentrate here mostly on the futility of a male endorsement of the conservative right only as a rebut to a growing number of MRAs calling for a strictly rightist partisan approach for the purposes of mediating MRA grievances. It should be a foregone conclusion, however, that throwing our chips in with the liberal left would provide to us an equally lackluster devotion to the core issues that MRAs seek to address. Now, the old adage, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, comes to the thinking MRA's mind when surveying the landscape of right versus left partisan politics, knowing that others would have us bury our heads in the sand, urging us to take part in their rituals of ineffectuality. Their political solutions, the milquetoast, write your congressman, the blatantly disingenuous, vote conservative, they're the lesser of two evils, get Obama out of office at all costs, tedium. When pointing out the futility of pulling down a lever for Mitt Romney come election time, partisan MRAs point out that the men's rights movement, in choosing to remain apolitical, will remain forever relegated to a cyber dungeon of sorts, the internet manosphere. Admittedly, the term apolitical, a term I've used before to describe that the men's rights movement should refuse to affiliate with any political party, is a bit misleading. Apartisan is much more descriptive for my idea of the political approach that the men's rights movement should take. Political action should undoubtedly be taken, sans the morass of the left or the chainmail suit of white knight chivalry that so encumbers the political right. The men's rights movement needs to be able to isolate and dispatch issues pertaining to its own interests with political expediency and without the crippling tithes that would be demanded of it under allegiance to any political party. The term as it stands is men's rights activists. Thus, our political activism should be concerned only with the issues that pertain to men's rights and the advocacy of them. When people, supporters or detractors, male or female, are confronted with the male rights activists, they should take away with them not a peculiar stench of republicanism or liberalism or any other political ism. They should take away a definitive idea that the MRA is concerned only with political issues relating to men. Now, the current conservative sales pitch is one that revolves around an, I'll say, partly flawed limited government approach. It is not flawed in its insistence of limiting government. Less government will definitively decrease the state's ability to use coercive state power against men. Where it is fundamentally flawed is in its reluctance to take part in, and even its stated goal to eliminate identity politics altogether. You see, it's human nature to advocate for one's associated group. Limiting government will never stop women from advocating on their own behalf for government benefit. No, you see, at best, limiting government will only serve to limit the amount of benefits that the varying groups bound to lobby government for their own interests will have access to. This is to say that unless conservative politics can force the state, which also operates in the interest of its own self-preservation, to operate under the absolute minimum amount of taxpayer dollars, which we all know is highly unlikely, there will always be a surplus of funds that will be designated by which political groups most effectively advocate for them. Now, I would love to live in a world where everyone agrees to play fair, where the politicized female collective will agree alongside the politicized male collective to simply not advocate politically for their own self-interest, but it simply is not a reality. Let's take, for example, the disparity in government funding for prostate and breast cancers. In fiscal year 2009, breast cancer research received $872 million worth of federal funding, while prostate cancer received $390 million. It's a well-known fact that prostate cancer and breast cancer kill men and women in equal rates. What happened? Women practice identity politics. They had no interest in demanding that government split the total $1.2 billion equally between the genders. They took more for themselves because they knew it would benefit their interests. It was women that kicked off massive breast cancer awareness initiatives. Men have not kicked off massive prostate cancer awareness initiatives. It was women that did the fundraising. They acted in the interest of their own gender by injecting their issues into the public consciousness. This is something that men must absolutely learn to do, identity politics. Male identity politics is essential when considering that women will, in fact, regardless of the size of government, petition government, and successfully, I might add, for all sorts of benefits for their gender. To suggest that men should focus entirely on limiting the size of government, completely discarding any self-interest, while women will most certainly not do the same thing, is not just ineffectual, but outright dangerous in that, as you can see, it translates directly to men being taxed in the majority for services that go in the majority to the benefit of women. Now, I'm all for limiting government, and yet what will reducing the size of government do in this case? It might mean that only $100 million will be spent on prostate cancer research, with $500 million going to breast cancer research, but the disparity will still be there. Considering that men pay the majority of taxes, and will continue to do so no matter how much one shrinks government, it's time we start demanding our share by practicing apartisan identity politics. The fundamental problem with the men's rights movement adopting a partisan approach to politics is that it depends on elected officials to do our bidding. We elect politician A under the inefficient pretense of the lesser of two evils political philosophy. Politician A has obligations towards constituency B, C, and D, and finally then to us MRAs, and in the event that constituencies B, C, and D's interests outweigh to that politician that of the MRA constituency, politician A may very well, by virtue of his job security, enact legislations not in keeping with, and even in direct contradiction to what his MRA constituency elected him for, and that is unacceptable. Constituencies advocating in this manner for their own self-interest via a politician must in fact render assistance to said politician's political campaign in the form of donations, in the form of public advertising, and a myriad of other political functions. All this energy expended still does not guarantee said politician's election, and said politician's election, as just mentioned, does not guarantee that he will act in keeping with the interests of one of the many constituencies that got him elected. Furthermore, the constituency in supporting said candidate now has, whether they like it or not, an affiliation with that specific candidate's political policies. This is a highly inefficient way to address our grievances in the political sphere. Take four completely hypothetical reasons. The Democratic Party. Let's say tomorrow, a prominent Democratic politician started insisting that MRA issues be taken seriously, and say one of those MRA issues is a complete separation of marriage and state, meaning that the state should have absolutely no authority in the definition of marriage whatsoever. We also know that a prominent liberal Democratic issue is that of gay marriage. MRAs could decide to throw their political support behind this Democratic politician. Yet in the end, he may decide it more politically prudent to attend to the need of his other constituency, that being gay men and women advocating for government legalization and recognition of same-sex marriage, thus in supporting this candidate, in telling ourselves, well, at least he's not Romney or another Bush and he does seem to support men's issues, we will have had achieved nothing other than securing another politician's livelihood for another term, while also expanding government's power to define and thus interfere into marriage, which is what got us into this mess in the first place. These ideas on marriage come not out of a desire to interfere with the political initiatives of the gay rights activists, but out of the fact that we have seen men consistently extorted and disenfranchised in all marital and familial realms of Western law. If we portray ourselves as men advocating for men, completely happy with different, ceremonial, non-governmental definitions of marriage for both heterosexual and homosexual couples, we very well may have sidestepped being at odds with an extremely well-funded and organized political infrastructure, the gay rights movement. If we were to take the same exact stance whilst affiliating ourselves with right-wing politics, we will be viewed as hostiles in a larger partisan political beef we did not start and cannot finish. Understand that no political party will ever have men's issues as the core or even the major proponent of their political platform. The political wedge issues of our time, acting in concert with biological proclivities of both men and women to protect and provide for the female gender, ensures that mixing MRA issues into either of the American political parties will result in our issues being forwarded immediately to the bottom of the political to-do list. We cannot afford to not be viewed by society as always being concerned with issues pertaining to men's rights or men's health, men's reproductive rights, male suicide, selective service, men's everything. Now, the thinking MRA, in response to the efforts of others to ring us into the GOP, may find himself in a voting booth where he will give pause almost certainly to a vote for Mitt Romney or any other conservative politician. He might ask himself about the war on terror, something that Mitt Romney will surely continue to perpetuate. He may say to himself, in voting for this presidential candidate, how many more men will die half a world away due in part to the vote I'm about to cast? He may say to himself, how will his supposed stance of limited government change the fact that my vote might contribute to the decade-plus-long act of sustained misandry that is the war on terror? But that same thinking MRA might give very little or even no pause to a class action lawsuit against the federal government citing selective service discrimination against men. He could easily understand a focused and isolated legal action stating that the government via selective service discriminates against men. He could read for himself that the clear intention of the class action suit is to either make women sign up as well or to do away with selective service registration altogether. The thinking MRA could easily get behind a class action lawsuit filed on the part of men demanding that hospitals have no authority to circumcise males without express adult consent of the male in question. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution states clearly, quote, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction, end quote. This can be taken to the Supreme Court if need be to do away permanently with alimony law. I would put my time and even my money behind such an effort. I won't, however, put my time and money behind Mitt Romney or Obama or even Ron Paul. Why? They aren't MRAs acting in the interest of men. This is something that the MRAs are going to have to do for themselves. If we want a male birth control pill, for example, men are going to have to organize, form public events in large numbers and with the media covering it, showing the relevant pharmaceutical companies that there exists a real demand for it. In doing so, we can also highlight which feminist groups are responsible for inhibiting the development of a male birth control pill. A non-biased soundbite from an MRA asking why feminists want birth control only for women would go a long way. I mean, there are a million things that we can do that Mitt Romney and his political party will never do for us. If we want things done, we're going to have to do it for ourselves. Now, if in the end, you still want to go vote for a conservative or a liberal or whatever, that's your individual choice, and I'm not going to try and stop you. but I and many others will not put our support behind the same old status quo establishment politicians that haven't done a damn thing for us for half a century. And I certainly will not allow or tolerate any other MRAs trying to make me support their right-wing or left-wing agendas. So I gotta say,